Mr. James, Reel 36. So could you talk us through the actual process of the medical board and how that worked?
Well, the news came that I had to go to Naples to see the specialist and the medical board. And the specialist report was given to me, and I had to go on 7 days before the medical board, which was a super doctor. And they questioned me about my situation, and how it was, and all that sort of thing, and what treatment I'd had, and what hospital did what to me, and so on. And the last English ENT specialist report on my hearing, that I had no hearing, very little left in my right ear, I was almost completely deaf, and that that situation would recover. That was known in those days as otitis media chronic, this middle ear infection with suppuration. But of course, it's now noise induced deafness. It is the sort of tag. And that I had had no directional sense of hearing at all, and that I had been nobody good at all in the front line because of my deafness. And lack of direction and so on. I would be all right as a serving soldier in category B1 permanent behind the line. I could do a useful job.
What does B1 permanent mean?
That I would be category B1 again.
And so what were the other categories? A1 was
for A1, B1 temporary, whilst you're unfit, with a hope of regaining your full powers and strength and becoming A1 again. But I had an irreversible situation with my ear and hearing.
And were the categories below that as well?
Yeah, I suppose so. But as far as I was concerned, I was B1 permanent.
What did you feel about that at that point?
I was very disappointed, and I heard her. Didn't want my parents to worry unduly about it because they didn't understand. But I really said that I got really what I call a bloody lot. I'm going to be deaf.
Did you feel you were luckier than some or unluckier than in terms of?
I should have died in Toronto, and I felt guilty of having survived, funnily enough. And I thought, you know, this. Here, we could have lived the rest of my life, but then I should have died on the 3rd of February 1943. Now you got there. And I was sent Thomas and knew all about this incident. He knew all about the sustained body as well. Before Salerno, he said, I don't think you should be ready, would you? I said, why not? He said, if it was me, he said, I would say, I'm not allowed to. Because I had pain.
So this trouble was already
I had
from
terrible shoot pain today. Yeah. I had pain as well. I knew about this.
Did you go to the doctor at all post February?
No, I knew. I had been to the hospital. So you said, you're a bloody fool, you are. Not to seek a better. I said, no, I'm going to slur. I'm going without being Italian. And Alison Thompson knew that on my determination to stay on and so on. But I had to obey the adjutant as a learner. So it was the pain and the condition previous to Salerno, but in money it came out of Salerno with more bombs and blasts causing separation. I didn't have separation from Salerno. The first separation was at Salerno.
So you were downgraded
to be one permanent.
And what happened then?
So the colonel, Colonel Hilliard, I looked for a colonel. He said, you are now then, Sergeant Major, on the permanent staff of the IRTB. And Captain Dabbs has given me a good report. You're very young. So he said, I know you're the chairman very well. I said, yes, I know you're the chairman so well. He said, we've got to get the general admiral. So anyway, he said, you're very young. He said, right, well, you at first, you were Captain Dabbs, and I'm sure that you at Captain Dabbs would do a very good job in handling the Scottish troops. He said, I must warn you that they're not the easiest of troops to discipline. I would probably discover problems. But I did, because I would wish my greatest enemy to have that job that I did at base. I would have given anything to get out of it. I would really, because it really was a very difficult job. You had to suffer insults. You had chaps who were on a draft to go to a casino, should we say, tomorrow morning, and they would do certain things to try to be on a chance to avoid the draft. You would know that this was their motive, and you'd have to suffer insults and criticisms.
So what would they do? What
would they would accuse you of being a yellow belly. Why aren't you going to come down yourself? You're going to push your bloody job down here with all the bullshit. All sort of thing, and you had to sort of swallow this and add insult to injury as well. You've had new young officers out from Sandhurst for England, and one night their lives were robbed, and I was being down, walking down the dark road alone, and I became aware and moved back to the officer's lines, and I stood there in the silence that I saw. There were thieves stealing the officer's kit. So it was pitch black in my centurion boy, and I said, "Right, you lads, up here, fall in here." And they did. I said, "Pick march." And I had three of them, and I marched them to the compound, to the regiment police compound, with all their booty, officers' brown boots, everything that was sold of the natives. They were deserters on the run, stealing. In the undercover darkness and flooded the Canadians. When they saw me in the Brisbane police light from the tiddy lamp, they said, "You're the bloke who caught us." I said, "Yes, because I was a little boyish looking young, whippersnapper." But I had a voice like thunder. And they looked at each other and laughed. They were on a charge anyway. And the officers who skipped the stolen in the company office present when the chap had been tried for, and they had been confronted by a CB, and fatigues and being spent and all sort of thing. And these officers turned to me in the presence of Captain Gabs and said, "Why aren't you in the front line, Sergeant Major? You look a very efficient, young, smart chap." And Captain Gabs turned to them and said, "You don't know what you're talking about, you ignorant young brats. You don't know this Sergeant Major. How dare you insult my Sergeant Major? He's a highly intelligent chap. He's not in a position to answer you back, but I am. Get out!" So he defended me. He said, "Sorry about that, Sergeant Major." He said, "But you found their kit and all sorts of things, and they insult you." I said, "Well, that's the answer to this as well, isn't it?"
What would have happened if you had exploded yourself and attacked them? Would you have got into trouble?
So you would still be in danger of being. I could have blasted them. I could have, but they didn't know. And this is what one had to endure, which is what needed me. I didn't want to stay in that place another moment, but I had to be there.
So what you were implying earlier was that men would deliberately try to get into trouble.
To get off the draft.
So what was the authority's response to that? How would they make sure that they did still get sent?
Well, they'd be on parade there, I'd call their names, and they'd be giving me verbal abuse. Jokes. Our relatives haven't heard of it. And I would say, "Right, the lorry is there, you're not going to miss the lorry, get on it." And if a sergeant's in charge of the draft, get on, sergeant. He must stay behind. This is what he wanted to do. I said, "I've got your measure."
And so you would ignore the insults?
I was tough. By now, it was like water running into the dust bag. I had to have a glass neck.
Could you talk us through a typical day as Sergeant Major here then at this stage of your career,
typical day would be first thing in the morning at the company office. You know that the sick parade is happening, you know there's certain chaps that are not going to be answering the roll call, maybe down the medical inspection room reporting sick for one reason or another. And so you wait for the medical to come back and you see exactly whether you start to figure. Otherwise, if they were MMD, medicine duty, they'd go and they'd be on the way. And there's certain sergeants who are waiting with their squads for days training. And they got deep training, field class training, and weapon training, and all sort of thing, and boot marches as well. Then you'd deal with your company correspondences or so on. If you've got your returns, so you've got your details.
What are your returns?
Could you the various returns, like to, you have to see the class, and your report on the sick and over here. You have to tell the class who came in from UK or from hospital, so that they would keep the company role intact and ready for them, especially at a month's notice. And also they were sending a vast, enormous, great big sheet, which measured about 3 foot by 2, with squares in it, which had to be the return, the daily return to Saint-Deschamps at Portici, so that they were up to date.
And that was the records, as you mentioned earlier, of everybody.
That's right.
In the Central American Forces.
You'd have to arrange for the guards for the night. There were sentries, guards, duties, sentry duties. You'd have to have your guards and sentry rota. You'd have to sort of make sure that the sergeants are fully rooted out in the day's training, and who he's got. And don't forget that all these chaps were temporary chaps on the IRTD. You had to give them a full day. They weren't allowed to sit in their tents and linger for a minute. They were active. They were out. They were doing things. And then they'd be back in their meals, supervision by the carousels and all sort of thing, and sentries, and so on. And it was a busy day. And you went to the company commander to inspect every tent, to see whose kit was in there. They had to have their kit made up, and he was a stickler for the Arabs. Their tents had to be immaculate, inside and out. They had to have sort of trenches around, including rain heavily, and everything was spick and span. He had one fault, Captain Dabbs. He kept on taking all the tents down and putting them in a different direction, and recreating the camp in a better way than he thought. It would suit his purpose. And this was one fault, he was forever taking the tents down and putting them on a different place. Well, these tents, they say, were in between the grapes, the grapevines, and they were fig trees as well. And so you could reach up and you could pick grapes and figs. One day, I went to them and I said, "Can you smell anything, sir?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "So can I, my God." I said, "Don't know what it is." God, nearer and nearer, it was like a sewage farm. Eventually, there was a big iron cart drawn by 2 oxen, with a woman standing in the iron tank, up to her neck in sewage, And she turned the oxen into the company lines, not that where the steps were, but, and she put the bucket in this filthy sewage and plopped it on the roots of the grapes. I ran down and I stopped her. I said, "Get out!" And I pulled the oxen around, 2 enormous oxen, and she kept protesting that this was the grapes of the contadini of the villagers, and that this was the sewage of fertilizer that was going on. Just in time, I pulled her away and got her, and pulled the oxen away, and, well, I never got over that day. They were going to put this human sewage outside every tent and every root of grapes.
at this stage, how long would these men be with you in the infantry post?
Sometimes one day, if they wanted, if they were short, maybe it was for Christmas. Sometimes one day.
Just one day?
Urgent call. Usually 3 or 4 days, no longer than about 4.
So you would never really get a chance to know any of
these. You'd never get a chance to know. You'd call them names, and you never had a chance to know them. But they were tough jocks.
And they were always Scottish.
They were all Scottish units, that's right. One bloke had absented himself, went up the village, and got drunk on this hooch, and he came back blind drunk, fell into a pond crater. How he got out, he was lucky to do so. Turned up at the company stores, sopping wet with all mud, effing and blinded and blind drunk, and wanted to fight everybody, including me. The staff were terrified. Sent to me, the company commander came and said, "Come on, Sunday, let's get down and see this man." We went into the big marquee, which was the company stores, and he said, "I want a complete outfit, and you are going to give it to me." So I said, "What's your name, Armstrong?" He said, "Nothing. You with your bullshit and your white belt and your effing anklets." He says, "You're not going to effing tell me what to do. I'm a frontline man." So I said, "Get your tent, Armstrong, and dry your clothes off." I said, "You'll be all right." He said, "I'm not going to do that." And he came forward to attack me. And I hit him an uppercut and knocked him out. When he came around, the Captain Dabbs got a bucket of water and threw a bucket of water over him. When he came around, he saw me and he went berserk and mad. And I thought, "I've got to get him out of this water." So I ran out of the tent. I didn't run away from him. I ran out of the tent to get him out of the stores. And then he started to try and kick me in the testicles. And he tried about 20 times before I was kind of his upswing of his boot, and then I stepped in and caught his foot and had him on one leg. And I just put him in a pen. He was put in the pen. The medical officer went to see me. He says, "I'm sorry to say, Sir Major, that you hit a man today and he's in the pen." I said, "That's right, sir." He said, "I've just been called here because he can't eat." He said, "You've broken his jaw." He said, "But," he said, "don't worry about it, really." He said, "I know the full story." He went to hospital and he was in hospital for 3 weeks. He came back and said, "Sir Major, I want to shake you by the hand. I was on a slippery slope, sir. I'm very sorry." I said, "No, go down, sir. You're on a court martial." And he was. And there's been, you know, that's one example. And he was sentenced, I think, to about a fortnight in the class, as all the correction unit. But he had a short sentence. But it was that's one of the episodes of 67 IRTD.
So there would be men that were trying to get into trouble, to get
absolutely
out of. And the army had to just have a strategy to make.
The most, I'm sorry to say it, and I hope that I don't become the Scottish regiments, but they were the most ill-disciplined, drunken, disobedient lot. And yet in battle, in action, they are the wild men. They are the women in skirts, you see. They are good in action, but out of it, bloody hell.
So, this would be a real contrast with your time with the 16th DLI.
Absolutely. You couldn't possibly reconcile the two. It was a different life. And I hated every minute of this because I had to take it.
Was there any sense of identity amongst the various NCOs? Was there any kind of sergeant's mess? Was there any way at this?
No, the NCOs were a motley crowd, actually. They were from all. They were themselves sort of disabled in one way or another.
But did you socialise? Could you socialise together?
There was, at this place eventually, we built a great big, when the line moved forward from Pacino, they built a great big mission hut thing. They called it the Sergeant's Mess. And for the first time ever in this camp, they had this big mission hut thing that gave us mess facilities, including itinerant sergeants, passing through all regiments as well, you know. But because of my banner, I'm an Italian, I used to go out to bed again to a place like that when I knew I could buy for the sergeant's mess 200 fresh eggs to augment our food. The rations were pretty small. We went over here at all. The food available in Italy wasn't very great. If I say so officer in the British Army, we had a tank like us, believe it or not. We weren't worth it at all. We just had not to subsist on, exist on. But I found his eggs, and we all paid out of our own pockets, and we had a board every now and again.
Do any of the other NCOs stick in your mind, any of the other men that you were working with?
Do
any of the other NCOs of that era do any personalities?
Oh yes, and I've got a photograph of them actually. There was one bloke, was a good pianist. He had a Scottish thing on, and he was forever drunk, but he could play the piano. And his favourite song, "Oh dear, what can that matter be? Three old ladies locked in the lavatory. They were there from Monday to Saturday. Nobody knew they were there." And he'd be playing the piano, he was marvellous. And we had his old piano from somewhere, and he gave us quite a good concert. And I, as well, with one, two sergeants, I was a bass. I joined in with a duet, and we stood by the piano, Colonel Haywood. And he didn't realise what talent we had about the sergeant's flesh, especially when he heard me singing in harmony with this other white dog, you know. We were called the two toughies. And we had competitions as well, singing the Ash Grove in harmony, and Green Sleeves, arranged by the party, these concerts.
And would these be concerts for the troops?
Be concerts for the troops, that's right, but there were few and far between. But we did put one or two on for the troops as well, or the passing through in that time, you know.
So, how long were you with the IRTD?
Well,
did that last?
That, I joined them, must have been after October 1943. And we moved into Italy before the end of the year, 1942, so we were there 1944. Casino was 1944, the height, you know, they were there for 8 months, stalemate at Casino. Couldn't move the jetties until the Poles launched the final attack. 8 months Casino lasted, there was stalemate there. And then Anzio happened, of course, we were very busy when Anzio happened, because we were sending reinforcements like Bingo to Anzio. Above Casino, bypassing Casino.
So how would that happen? Men would turn
up. I see.
How would you organise that? What would
when they had the Anzio landings, the seaborne landing city of Salerno, higher up the coast, you know, so that the Jerry's would sort of probably get out of for Rome, to take Rome. There were a lot of casualties in Anzio, and consequently there was a large demand.
Would that mean that people would be coming into the IRTD and being processed through it?
That's right. There's a big demand for reinforcements, and there's a lot of casualties at Anzio. And so it made us very, very busy. In addition to the normal line, which was sort of static, Anzio made us very busy.
Did you notice? I mean, obviously, these men were passing through, and you didn't get to know them very well or at all. But could you detect a change in the morale of the unit at different stages of the war? What was the times when you felt?
As I stated, I only dealt with the Scottish regiments, you see, and the Scottish regiments, you know, I mean, they're numerous. And don't forget that other Scottish regiments as well that weren't under me, like the Black Watch, or the Red Hackle. They were in D Company.
Where were the DLI?
DLI was in Cervinara. They were about 4 or 5 miles from me in the next village, Cervinara. So I never saw them, but I went down there and I didn't see them, anybody. And I bumped into Captain Wayland, Joe Wayland. And I didn't know he was there.
What was he doing there?
When I went down to Cervinara on this particular day to see Lenny Dunham's there, I didn't see any, but they had their film show pending. And we were sitting down waiting for the film to start. And I heard somebody say, "Well, Major." And I looked around, Joe Wayland. I said, "Well, about 2 or 6 behind me." I said, "Good God, sir." I said, "How nice to see you." I said, "I know that I heard of your medal status." I said, "Are you one of the men, sir?" So he said, "I'm on the way home." Oh, well, he didn't want to say it, but he was finished. Information on the plane. And he was in one. You know, after doing a small chat, and the film started, and I sat with him from the film. And well, Chandanara, it's another thing was that in this region there were raids everywhere and thieves, Italians, who couldn't leave a lorry for 2 minutes anywhere, the tires and the wheels would go. And so there was a great big drive on catching these criminals who were civilians aided by army British deserters. So I was involved in that as well, in laying traps and fighting the criminal element together with British deserters. And that's another story.
Could you describe your involvement, how that worked?
Well, yes. We were told one night, that's right, the Americans, and there's a book incidentally on this called, it's called Naples 2024. I got the book in there, by Norman Lewis. It's a fantastic book. It covers every aspect of exactly what I was living through. Lorries being stolen by these civilians, black marketed tires and petrol, you know, raids on camps, such as ours, and being aware of deserters and Italians from Naples liable to attack any minute in armed raids to steal whatever they could. So on one or two occasions I went out with parties to try and set a trap on the rest of them. But there's a book in there. It's great.
But in terms of your own experiences, how would these ambushes work? How would you try to attract
They would set roadblocks at various points, together with the regimental police, and British Army regimental police, and they would have certain information from the Camorra, in the Naples Mafia, you know, and the British would be informed by the SIB, Special Investigation Branch, that they'd be operating in the area, and that we would be on the alert and so on and so forth, you know. And it was actually a very, very important, it was the bane of my life, thieving and the, deserters, and you knew they were all around you.
Did you ever catch any?
Oh, yes.
Could you describe some of
these? Oh, I went out one night with this party, it was 6 or 7 of us, fully armed, and an officer, in transport up to this village. And we met up with some Yanks who said that they thought that there were an armed couple in a particular building. So we raided the building, got upstairs, I went into the bedroom, there's a British soldier in bed with a woman. He jumped through this window, it was about 3 stories high, with his trousers in his hand, and tried to get away, because he was arrested, he was there illegally.
Did you find out where he was from or what he was?
He was one of the criminals.
He was just an ordinary man.
He was there. With his prostitute.
But he wasn't part of the gang. He just happened to be.
Yeah. No, but he was roped in because he shouldn't be there anyway.
And did you catch the real culprits? Did you catch?
We did personally, but we were close on their tails. They were caught by the. Carabinieri, the Italian police, who worked close with us as well. Carabinieri.